E2, number 23A.
We started yesterday with the epistles and trying to see if within that whole framework of those many epistles and the whole message and theory of Christianity, if there is not a ordered presentation that would help us to see the whole structure and therefore matrix of that whole period, which is what? It is fundamentally what we call Christianity, but Christianity is fundamentally what? The reciprocal relation from man to the Word of God, the relation from man to Christ. See, these are the verticals, from man to Christianity, from man to science, and thereby showing that if man has that relationship to these four, that then these four have a relationship on man, that they have an impact on man, that we are not finding our true relationship with the calculus without that the calculus begins to demonstrate itself in our lives. That's why these epistles are so full of practical living, because each one of them shows us what is the impact of the Word and the Christ and Christianity and science on men, on our life. We have considered the first vertical, the Word, showing man's relationship to the grace of God. That was our first column, our relationship to the grace of God, wherein then the epistle showed that if we are actually accepting that faith, that we will experience in Romans the grace. Just when you once have time, read Romans. It's terrifically freeing, you know. He just shows how we are brought out of the Old Testament, and that we live now by the grace of God, and that we are now justified right now before God, that there is a righteousness which is above the human righteousness. It's now the righteousness that is before God. That's what he shows there, that we are now free, a terrific sense of freedom. Then he shows our relationship to the grace of God is bringing in 1 Corinthians a new style of life, if we really accept that Roman standpoint, that at 1 Corinthians it transforms us and gives to each one, no matter if he has been a robber and a thief and I don't know what, a new style of life, a new life. But that he goes on and says, but you have to stick to that new faith, to that new vision, through all the tribulations. And in 2 Corinthians, Paul tells them how he was victorious in all tribulations. And he is recounting them all the various tribulations he went through, and told them, look here, I'm still alive, I'm victorious, I triumph over every difficulty. And then James tells us that actually we are only proving our faith by living it. Faith must be coupled by works, and that is the only proof, science, of the new faith. So I want to continue now with the second vertical, with man's reciprocal relationship with the glory of Christ, or the fullness of Christ, as we could also show it. What he therefore here wants to show is a step further than the word vertical. Namely, these epistles all show that through man's relationship with the whole of Christ. It's always the wholeness, the fullness, the glory of Christ that man really partakes of the whole salvation and of the whole saving power of the Christ, and not just of a little bit. It is the accent, therefore, here is on that fullness and glory and wholeness that is shown here. The very first one is Galatians, from the point of view of the word, of accepting what? And you can see what he must tell us here now. We are now at the point where we should be able to reason out what Galatians would have to tell us, namely that we accept the new faith. Which new faith? That the Christ is the fullness of Christ, the all-embracing sense of the Christ, and that therefore we do not need any other Christ, any other saving power. This is Galatians. Therefore, it is that proposition in each one of our human experience which says at every point where we have to solve something, is the Christ sufficient to solve it, or should I have something besides the Christ? Shall I have a Christian Science treatment and a little bit of medicine or not? Shall I work it out, some kind of trouble I have with my neighbor on the basis of the Christ, or shall I also ask a lawyer? It's always that question, is the Christ sufficient or not? That's Galatians. And if we don't know anything about the text of Galatians, anyone knows something, namely, O ye foolish Galatians. I think that has gone into the vocabulary of practically every Christian nation, that Paul said, O ye foolish Galatians. Perhaps not knowing why he said so, but he said them out of this very reason, that he said to them, you don't trust the Christ completely. You have not the glory of Christ. You accept the Christ, but not the glory of it, not the fullness of it. You always are trying to work out things on a dual basis, on the basis that you have found the new faith, that is grace, but, which is the glory of the Christ, but you also try to work out things with the help of other means. So you have two kinds of saviors with which you work, and he is reproaching them with that, O ye foolish Galatians, and is telling them that they should accept, that's the word, the new teaching he has been giving them, that the Christ is all sufficient. You have here this very point that Christ, that Galatians tells us about the all sufficiency of the Christ method of salvation. That there is only one Christ really, one saving method really. He shows that again through the order of the synonymous terms, and with each synonymous term he shows that each synonymous term is sufficient for a situation, and that we don't need to work with the synonymous terms plus some human agency. That's Galatians. Now, he goes on showing that fullness of the Christ when he comes to Ephesians, and Ephesians is at the point of intersection with the horizontal Christ, so we come to Christ as a very important point, which says that if we're claiming the fullness of the glory of Christ, that will transform us. You remember yesterday we said this claiming brings transformation or reformation, and in Ephesians he really shows that if we claim the Christ in its fullness, entirely, so to say, then the fullness of the Christ will be at work in us. He shows now the Emmanuel, Christ in us, that the Christ will work in us and will resurrect us from a sense of limitation, a sense of lack or anything, because it's the fullness. I am now tempted to say it with everyone that I explain here and say, go and read it. Because the way Paul is showing these short epitomes is really impressive. You can't fail being touched, really, in Ephesians, for instance, how he shows that the whole fullness of the glory of Christ is working in us when we claim it, and that what he does, that he really resurrects us from every lack and shows then how everything within us just is bound together. You know, he has that wonderful way of showing, perhaps I don't find the terms, how everything links together in one consistent whole. He is very hot on that one, to show that there is not one point lacking in within us if we accept that. That everything works together, so to say, for good. That everything is jointed, fitted. He uses these terms of fitly joined together. Doesn't he say something in English that way? Huh? Fitly joined together. And you just can see, really, the that garment without seam and rent that he presents here. So that at no point, really, is there any lack or limitation. Then he goes a step further, and he comes, really, to Philippians. And in Philippians, again, he shows men's reciprocal relationship with the glory of Christ. But here now, he shows that if we cling steadfastly and abide steadfastly in that we will gain a victory. And the victory he shows here is that if we are really abiding joyfully, he has a great sense of joy, which gives a sense that this is not a strenuous work to be one with the Christ, to abide with the Christ, that this is not a hard job and burdensome job, that should be something that is full of joy, that we joyfully are preserving our unity with the glory of Christ and are striving in it to keep up that joy, that then imperfection will yield to perfection, and you have the victory. So can you see again how he points out, really, that the gospel, the good spell, is really a joyful and a joyous message that he has brought, though he had gone through many tribulations. You see, right before, on the same line, on the horizontal, you have 2 Corinthians, where he showed all the tribulation he went through. But then when you come to Philippians, on the same horizontal, he is showing that actually we should see that there is joy in it, and that it isn't that tribulation becomes joy, that actually trials are proofs of God's care, and that we should rejoice in these tribulations, and he rejoices in tribulation. He isn't burdened by it. And Philippians shows that if we stick to that imperfection will be changed into perfection, man triumphs. In 1st and 2nd Peter, the story, again, is a bit different because it has to do with that horizontal of science, of proving our faith by living it. He would show in those two epistles, in Peter, that actually to stick to the glory of the Christ and living our faith, that we shouldn't really be involved in sacrifice and tribulation. And though outwardly, humanly, this is so, we should be strong enough in our understanding and are forced, therefore, through those tribulations to grow in understanding. Second Peter is quite an interesting epistle. When reading it, I didn't quite see on the first and second and third go what he is actually driving at. But little by little one began to see that he shows how the glory, the full glory of the Christ is working within us really a higher understanding, so that we begin to prove a higher sense of life. In other words, that the Christ has, so to say, a purpose, and that purpose is not just to be a help in tribulation, but more than that, that in tribulation we really gain a higher understanding. And each one of us knows that that is true. That in times of trouble and in striving and in times of, struggling with a problem, that these are usually the best times, not only in gaining a victory over that problem, but that we always come out with a higher understanding. And he's showing really that only understanding produces understanding, that Christ's idea will bring forth higher and higher understanding within us through tribulation. He also shows in the first epistle, I think, very much that though so much sacrifice and tribulation is involved, we really should always regard that not as something bad, but as a means of the Christ to help us to go forward. It's interesting, you see, that actually what he tries to show here is that the Christ always blesses, and that we make progress either through suffering or science. That's Mrs. Eddy's great war song, that it is either through suffering or science. The first epistle is through suffering and the second through science, but both together yielding a higher understanding. Now, in a similar way, not quite in the exact way, but somehow in tone, you remember we had here in the Christ matrix, we had here Jeremiah. And Jeremiah was saying something like that. He was saying to Israel, said, you know, you are a stiff-necked nation, and you are just slowly going down and down and down with all your temple and with all your priests and high priests and everything. You just go slowly down, and there is no hope for you except God sends you into the Babylonic captivity. That's the best thing that can happen to you. You see, he could see the way through suffering, and then he would predict them and foretell them that in that state of suffering and captivity in Babylon, they will begin to learn the law of God, so that the law will be in the heart of each one. Can you see? He was preparing at that very same point the idea in Israel to see that the Christ can use both means, the means of suffering and the means of science, in order to foster what? The understanding of in the people. So first and second Peter takes up that very thing and shows that in our life, living by proving, in our lives we constantly have to prove our new vision, our new faith. And this is also an answer to many, many, many students who attend, say, summer school like we have this week, that they feel, oh, it's wonderful, and they are lifted right up into cloud nine, and then they think, now, from now on, everything will just be fine and just be a rosy path. And then they go back, and then afterwards they tell me, I never had such a bad time, or I never had so many difficulties, and think this is wrong. But if they would know the matrix, they would think, no, this is right. Because what's the use of seeing something higher and not be able to have a chance to prove it? It would stay theoretical if we wouldn't have a chance to prove it. The only thing is that we should see through such a situation and not see that it is something bad that happens, but that it is a higher demand on our understanding, and say, now, prove what you have learned. Then we would accept it with joy. Like Philippians has said, approach your tribulation with joy and not with your head hanging down, with a sadness, but with joy. Then you can experience 1st and 2nd Peter as a joyous progress in understanding and tackling the new problems and the more severe problems that meet us with the same joy from a higher standard, and then we can prove it also from a higher point of view. So this would be all wrong if you would think that the more we learn, the less problem we should have to solve. We should expect, really, that the more we learn, the higher the problem would be to be solved. If I go into a higher class in mathematics and begin to learn, say, integral calculus or differential calculus, I do not expect that the teacher gives me a problem which said, what is 5 plus 3? He doesn't go back to simple arithmetic, but he will put in front of me a problem of that same caliber, of a differential calculus or of an integral calculus, and say, now you solve it, now try, can you solve it? And so it is in the science of being, in the science of life, that the moment consciousness is awakened to a higher method of dealing with the problem, then these problems will arise and will present themselves. Yes? So, be on your toes, be prepared that you go out and say, okay, nothing can happen, because you have learned in the textbook matrix, you have learned at the point of apocalypse that whatever will happen in the future is the idea of principle working. It will never be animal magnetism as the 7 vile fools of the last plague. It is always an angel that presents us the 7 vile fools of the last plague. Never forget that. It's the angel, it's the idea. And this Christianity matrix prepares us really for accepting afterwards the textbook matrix. Yes. Well, that's 1st and 2nd Peter. So we come to the next vertical, Christianity as man's perfection. But we must be clear what is here shown. The whole Christianity sense is always a reciprocal sense. The moment you have Christianity, you have always a two-way sense. It's always reciprocal interrelationship. The moment Christianity is at the point of interrelationship, there you always have a two-way relationship. And here it is, therefore, man's reciprocal relationship to what? To man's perfection. So what is presented here is our relationship to what we are as the idea of men. And seeing what we are as the idea of men has naturally its further relationship, that the idea man has its relationship to us humanly, and therefore will bring forth more and more our perfection, man's own perfection. He starts out with Colossians, very short epistle which he writes, and he shows what? First is the word, the statement of the word, which says, accept what? Can you now see what he must show? He must now show that we should accept what? That we are the idea of perfection, that man is perfect. This is what Christian Science usually tells us and says, well, you don't need to accept yourself as a sinner and as sick, but accept yourself as the perfect idea, and this will reveal to you. It's still at the point of the word, and this will reveal to you your true selfhood and show that your true selfhood is really perfect before God. And he shows that no mortal sensehood belongs anymore to you. Can you see what the point of intersection is? Very simple. Just showing that we have to accept the fact that we are the perfect idea of man, and that therefore we are not a mortal. This is Colossians. And then he writes two very small letters, short letters, sorry, 1 Thessalonians, and then afterwards 2 Thessalonians. And just take 1 Thessalonians. What does he show there? And now let's reason what he has to show there if our I and J index is right. He would have to show what in the vertical man's perfection in some way. But in which way? Namely, in the horizontal as the Christ, which says that in the measure as we claim man's perfection, and then you add claiming brings transformation, that by claiming man's perfection, that we are the sons of God, that this would transform us, that this does resurrect us actually. It's the actual operation of it. Can you see that Colossians didn't say that we are actually transformed? He just said, accept that you are the perfect idea, namely that man is a perfect idea, and therefore don't accept that you are a mortal. That's the statement. But he goes on and says, but if you stick, if you claim and if you stick to this new vista, then that stickingness is naturally one's identity with the Christ. It's one's agreement, one's atonement, one's at-one-ment with this idea. That is a consciousness that has power and that actually, in actual experience, begins to transform you, and it begins to resurrect you.